at a distant university, teaching people she never met face to face, grading English papers sent to her over the computer, and sending messages of advice or encouragement back. Her father taught particle physics, but there were, Scarlett told Bod, too many people who wanted to teach particle physics and not enough people who wanted to learn it. So, Scarlett's family had to keep moving to different university towns, and in each town, her father would hope for a permanent teaching position that never came.
What's particle physics?
Scarlett shrugged.
Well, there's atoms, which is things that are too small to see. That's what we're all made of. And there's things that's smaller than atoms. And that's particle physics.
Bod nodded and decided that Scarlett's father was probably interested in imaginary things. Bod and Scarlett wandered the graveyard together every weekday afternoon, tracing names with their fingers, writing them down. Bod would tell Scarlett whatever he knew of the inhabitants of the grave, or mausoleum, or tomb, and she would tell him stories that she had been read or learned. And sometimes she would tell him about the world outside, about cars and buses and television and aeroplanes. Bod had seen them flying high overhead, had thought them loud silver birds, but had never been curious about them until now. He, in his turn, would tell her about the days when the people in the graves had been alive, how Sebastian Reader had been to London town and had seen the Queen, who had been a fat woman in a fur cap, who had glared at everyone and spoke no English. Sebastian Reader could not remember which Queen she had been, but he did not think she had been Queen for very long.
When was this?
He died in 1583. It says on his tombstone. So before then.
Who is the oldest person here, in the whole graveyard?
Bod frowned.
Probably Caius Pompeius. He came here 100 years after the Romans first got here. He told me about it. He liked the roads.
So he's the oldest?
I think so.
Can we make a little house in one of those stone houses?
You can't get in. It's locked. They all are.
Can you get in?
Of course.
Why can't I?
The graveyard. I got the freedom of the graveyard. It lets me go places.
I want to go in the stone house and make little houses.
You can't.
You're just mean.
Not.
Meany.
Not.
Scarlett put her hands into the pocket of her anorak and walked down the hill without saying goodbye, convinced that Bod was holding out on her and at the same time suspecting that she was being unfair, which made her angrier. That night over dinner, she asked her mother and father if there was anyone in the country before the Romans came.
Where did you hear about the Romans?
Everybody knows. Was there?
There were Celts. They were here first. They go back before the Romans. They were the people that the Romans conquered.
On the bench beside the old chapel, Bod was having a similar conversation.
The oldest? Honestly, Bod, I don't know. The oldest in the graveyard that I've encountered is Caius Pompeius. But there were people here before the Romans came, lots of them, going back a long time. How are your letters coming along?
Good, I think. When do I learn joined-up letters?
Silas paused.
I have no doubt,
he said, after a moment's reflection,
that there are, among the many talented individuals interred here, at least a smattering of teachers. I shall make inquiries.
Bod was thrilled, He imagined a future in which he could read everything, in which all stories could be opened and discovered. When Silas had left the graveyard to go about his own affairs, Bod walked to the willow tree beside the old chapel and called Caius Pompeius. The old Roman came out of his grave with a yawn.
Ah, yes, the living boy. How are you, living boy?
I do very well, sir.
Good. I am pleased to hear it.
The old Roman's hair was pale in the moonlight, and he wore the toga in which he had been buried, with beneath it a thick woolen vest and leggings, because this was a cold country, at the edge of the world, and the only place colder was Caledonia to the north, where the men were more animal than human, and covered in orange fur, and were too savage even to be conquered by the Romans, so would soon be walled off in their perpetual winter.
Are you the oldest?
The oldest in the graveyard. I am.
So, you were the first to be buried here?
A hesitation.
Almost the first. Before the Celts, there were other people on this island. One of them was buried here.
Oh.
Bod thought for a moment.
Where's his grave?
Caius pointed up the hill.
He's up at the top?
Caius shook his head.
Then what?
The old Roman reached down and he ruffled Bod's hair.
In the hill. Inside it. I was first brought here by my friends, followed in their turn by the local officials and the mimes, who wore the wax faces of my wife, taken by a fever in Camulodunum, and my father, killed in a border skirmish in Gaul. 300 years after my death, a farmer, seeking a new place to graze his sheep, discovered the boulder that covered the entrance and rolled it away and went down thinking there might be treasure. He came out a little later, his dark hair now as white as mine.
What did he see?
Caius said nothing. Then?
He would not speak of it, or ever return. They put the boulder back, and in time, they forgot. And then, 200 years ago, when they were building the Frobisher vault, they found it once more. The young man who found the place dreamed of riches, so he told no one, and he hid the doorway behind Ephraim Petifer's casket, and went down one night, unobserved. Or so he thought.
Was his hair white when he came up?
He did not come up.
So, who is buried down there?
Caius shook his head.
I do not know, young Owens, but I felt him back when this place was empty. I could feel something waiting even then, deep in the hill.
What was he waiting for?
All I could feel was the waiting.
Scarlet was carrying a large picture book, and she sat next to her mother on the green bench near the gates. And she read her book while her mother inspected an educational supplement. She enjoyed the spring sunshine, and she did her best to ignore the small boy who waved at her first from behind an ivy-covered monument. Then, when she had resolved to no longer look at the monument, the boy popped up, literally like a jack-in-the-box, from behind a tombstone. Joji G. Shoji, died 1921. I was a stranger, and you took me in. He gestured towards her frantically. She ignored him. Eventually, she put her book down on the bench.
Mummy? I'm going for a walk now.
Stay on the path, dear.
She stayed on the path until she was round the corner, and she could see Bod waving at her from further up the hill. She made a face at him.
I found things out.
Me too.
There were people before the Romans, way back. They lived, I mean, when they died, they put them underground in these hills with treasure and stuff. And they were called barrows.
Oh, right. That explains it. Do you want to come and see one?
Now?
Scarlet looked doubtful.
You don't really know where one is, do you? And you know I can't always follow you where you go.
She had seen him slip through walls like a shadow. In reply, he held up a large, rusted iron key.
This was in the chapel. It should open most of the gates up there. They used the same key for all of them. It was less work.
She scrambled up the hillside beside him.
You're telling the truth?
He nodded, a pleased smile dancing at the corners of his lips.
Come on.
It was a perfect spring day, and the air was alive with birdsong and bee hum. The daffodils bustled in the breeze, and here and there, on the side of the hill, a few early tulips nodded. A blue powdering of forget-me-nots, and fine fat yellow primroses punctuated the green of the slope, as the two children walked up the hill toward the Frobisher's little mausoleum. It was old and simple in design, a small, forgotten stone house with a metal gate for a door. Bod unlocked the gate with his key, and they went in.
It's a hole, or a door, behind one of the coffins.
They found it behind a coffin on the bottom shelf, a simple crawl space.
Down there. We go down there.
Scarlet found herself suddenly enjoying the adventure rather less.
We can't see down there. It's dark.
I don't need light. Not while I'm in the graveyard.
I do. It's dark.
Bod thought about the reassuring things that he could say, like,
there's nothing bad down there.
But the tales of hair turning white and people never returning meant that he could not have said them with a clear conscience. So he said,
I'll go down. You wait for me up here.
Scarlet frowned.
You shouldn't leave me.
I'll go down and I'll see who's there and I'll come back and tell you all about it.
He turned to the opening, bent down and clambered through on his hands and knees. He was in a space big enough to stand up in, and he could see steps cut into the stone.
I'm going down the steps now.
Do they go down a long way?
I think so.
If you held my hand and told me where I was walking, then I could come with you. If you make sure I'm okay.
Of course.
And before he had finished speaking, the girl was coming through the hole on her hands and her knees.
You can stand up.
He took her hand.
The steps are just here. If you put a foot forward, you can find it. There. Now I'll go first.
Can you really see?
It's dark, but I can see.
He began to lead Scarlet down the steps, deep into the hill, and to describe what he saw to her as they went.
It's steps down, made of stone. And there's stone all above us. Someone's made a painting on the wall.
What kind of painting?
A big, hairy C is for cow, I think, with horns. Then something that's more like a pattern, like a big knot. It's sort of carved in the stone, too. Not just painted, see?
He took her fingers and placed them onto the carved knotwork.
I can feel it!
Now the steps are getting bigger. We're coming out into some kind of big room now, but the steps are still going. Don't move. Okay, now I am between you and the room. Keep your left hand on the wall.
They kept going down.
One more step, and we are on the rock floor. It's a bit uneven.
The room was small. There was a slab of stone on the ground and a low ledge in one corner with some small objects on it. There were bones on the ground, very old bones indeed, although below where the steps entered the room, Bod could see a crumpled corpse, dressed in the remains of a long brown coat. The young man who had dreamed of riches, Bod decided, he must have slipped and fallen in the dark. The noise began all about them, a rustling slither, like a snake twining through dry leaves. Scarlet's grip on Bod's hand was harder.
What's that? Do you see anything?
No.
Scarlet made a noise. There was half gasp and half wail, and Bod saw something, and he knew without asking that she could see it too. There was a light at the end of the room, and in the light a man came walking through the rock, and Bod heard Scarlet choking back a scream. The man looked well preserved, but still like something that had been dead for a long while. His skin was painted, Bod thought. Or tattooed, Scarlet thought, with purple designs and patterns. Around his neck hung a necklace of sharp, long teeth.
I am the master of this place,
said the figure, in words so ancient and guttural that they were scarcely words at all.
I guard this place from all who would harm it.
His eyes were huge in his head. Bod realized it was because he had circles drawn around them in purple, making his face look like an owl's.
Who are you?
He squeezed Scarlet's hand as he said it. The indigo man did not seem to have heard the question. He looked at them fiercely.
Leave this place,
he said, in words that Bod heard in his head, words that were also a guttural growl.
Is he going to hurt us?
I don't think so.
Then, to the indigo man, he said, as he had been taught,
I have the freedom of the graveyard, and I may walk where I choose.
There was no reaction to this by the indigo man, which puzzled Bod even more, because even the most irritable inhabitants of the graveyard had been calmed by this statement.
Scarlet, can you see him?
Of course I can see him. He's a big, scary, tattooy man, and he wants to kill us. Bod, make him go away!
Bod looked at the remains of the gentleman in the brown coat. There was a lamp beside him, broken on the rocky floor.
He ran away. He ran because he was scared. And he slipped or he tripped on the stairs and he fell off.
Who did?
The man on the floor.
Scarlet sounded irritated now, as well as puzzled and scared.
What man on the floor? It's too dark. The only man I can see is the tattooy man.
And then, as if to make quite sure that they knew that he was there, the indigo man threw back his head and let out a series of yodeling screams, a full-throated ululation that made Scarlet grip Bod's hand so tightly that her fingernails pressed into his flesh. Bod was no longer scared, though.
I'm sorry I said they were imaginary. I believe now. They're real.
The indigo man raised something over his head. It looked like a sharp stone blade.
All who invade this place will die,
Bod thought about the man whose hair had turned white after he had discovered the chamber, how he would never return to the graveyard or speak of what he had seen.
Oh, I think you're right. I think this one is.
Is what?
Imaginary.
Don't be stupid. I can see it.
Yes, and you can't see dead people.
He looked around the chamber.
You can stop now. We know it's not real.
I will feast on your liver.
Oh, no you won't. Bod's right. I think maybe it's a scarecrow.
What's a scarecrow?
It's a thing farmers put in fields to scare crows.
Why would they do that?
Bod quite liked crows. He thought they were funny. And he liked the way they helped keep the graveyard tidy.
I don't know exactly. I'll ask Mummy. But I saw one from a train and I asked what it was. Crows think it's a real person. It's just a made-up thing that looks like a person, but it's not. It's just to scare the crows away.
Bod looked around the chamber.
Whoever you are, it isn't working. It doesn't scare us. We know it isn't real. Just stop.
The indigo man stopped. It walked over to the rock slab and it lay down on it. Then it was gone. For Scarlet, the chamber was once more swallowed by the darkness, but in the darkness she could hear the twining sound again, getting louder and louder, as if something was circling the round room.
We are the Sleer.
The hairs on the back of Bod's neck began to prickle. The voice in his head was something very old and very dry, like the scraping of a dead twig against the window of the chapel. And it seemed to Bod that there was more than one voice there, that they were talking in unison.
Did you hear that?
I didn't hear anything, just a slithery noise. It made me feel strange, all prickly in my tummy, like something horrible is going to happen.
Nothing horrible is going to happen.
Then, to the chamber, he said,
What are you?
We are the Sleer. We guard and we protect.
What do you protect?
The resting place of the Master. This is the holiest of all holy places, and it is guarded by the Sleer.
You can't touch us. All you can do is scare.
Fear is a weapon of the Sleer.
Bod looked down at the ledge.
Are those the treasures of your master? An old brooch, a cup, and a little stone knife. They don't look like much.
The Sleer guards the treasures, the brooch, the goblet, the knife. We guard them for the Master. When he returns, it comes back. It always comes back.
How many of you are there?
But the Sleer said nothing. The inside of Bod's head felt as if it were filled with cobwebs, and he shook it, trying to clear it. Then he squeezed Scarlet's hand.
We should go.
He led her past the dead man in the brown coat, and honestly, thought Bod, if he hadn't got scared and fallen, the man would have been disappointed in his hunt for treasure. The treasures of 10,000 years ago were not the treasures of today. Bod led Scarlet carefully up the steps, through the hill, into the jutting black masonry of the Frobisher Mausoleum. Late spring sunlight shone through the breaks in the masonry and through the barred door, shocking in its brightness, and Scarlet blinked and covered her eyes at the suddenness of the glare. Birds sang in the bushes. A bumblebee droned past. Everything was surprising in its normality. Bod pushed open the mausoleum door and then locked it again behind them. Scarlet's bright clothes were covered in grime and cobwebs, and her dark face and hands were pale with dust. Further down the hill, somebody, quite a few somebodies, was shouting. Shouting loudly. Shouting frantically.
Scarlet! Scarlet Perkins!
Yes? Hello?
And before she and Bod had a chance to discuss what they had seen, or to talk about the Indigo Man, there was a woman in a fluorescent yellow jacket with police on the back, demanding to know if she was okay and where she had been and if someone had tried to kidnap her. And then the woman was talking on a radio, letting them know that the child had been found. Bod slipped along beside them as they walked down the hill. The door to the chapel was open, and inside, both of Scarlet's parents were waiting, her mother in tears, her father worriedly talking to people on a mobile phone, along with another policewoman. No one saw Bod as he waited in the corner. The people kept asking Scarlet what had happened to her, and she answered as honestly as she could, told them about a boy called Nobody, who took her deep inside a hill, where a purple tattoo man appeared in the dark. But he was really a scarecrow. They gave her a chocolate bar, and they wiped her face, and asked if the tattooed man had ridden a motorbike. And Scarlet's mother and father, now that they were relieved and not afraid for her any longer, were angry with themselves and with her. And they told each other that it was the other one's fault for letting their little girl play in a cemetery, even if it was a nature reserve, and that the world was a very dangerous place these days, and if you didn't keep your eyes on your children every second, you could not imagine what awful things they would be plunged into, especially a child like Scarlet. Scarlet's mother began sobbing, which made Scarlet cry, and one of the police women got into an argument with Scarlet's father, who tried to tell her that he, as a taxpayer, paid her wages, and she told him that she was a taxpayer too, and probably paid his wages. While Bod sat in the shadows in the corner of the chapel, unseen by anyone, not even Scarlet, and watched and listened until he could take no more. It was twilight in the graveyard by now, and Silas came and found Bod up near the amphitheatre, looking out over the town. He stood beside the boy, and he said nothing, which was his way.
It wasn't her fault. It was mine. And now she's in trouble.
Where did you take her?
Into the middle of the hill. To see the oldest grave. Only there isn't anybody in there. Just a snaky thing called a sleer, who scares people.
Fascinating.
They walked back down the hill together, watched as the old chapel was locked up once more. And the police and Scarlet and her parents went off into the night.
Miss Burrows will teach you joined-up letters. Have you read The Cat in the Hat yet?
Yes, ages ago. Can you bring me more books?
I expect so.
Do you think I'll ever see her again?
The girl? I very much doubt it.
But Silas was wrong. 3 weeks later, on a grey afternoon, Scarlet came to the graveyard, accompanied by both her parents. They insisted that she remain in sight at all times, although they trailed a little behind her. Scarlet's mother occasionally exclaimed about how morbid this all was and how fine and good it was that they would soon be leaving it behind forever. When Scarlet's parents began to talk to each other, Bod said,
Hello.
Hi.
I didn't think I'd see you again.
I told them I wouldn't go with them unless they brought me back here one last time.
Go where?
Scotland. There's a university there for Dad to teach particle physics.
They walked on the path together. A small girl in a bright orange anorak and a small boy in a grey winding sheet.
Is Scotland a long way away?
Yes.
Oh.
I hoped you'd be here to say goodbye.
I'm always here.
But you aren't dead, are you, Nobody Owens?
Of course not.
Well, you can't stay here all your life, can you? One day you'll grow up and then you will have to go and live in the world outside.
He shook his head.
It's not safe for me out there.
Who says?
Silas, my family, everybody.
She was silent.
Scarlet! Come on, love. Time to go. You've had your last trip to the graveyard. Now let's go home.
Scarlet said to Bod,
You're brave. You're the bravest person I know. And you are my friend. I don't care if you are imaginary.
Then she fled down the path, back the way they had come, to her parents and the world. Chapter 3 The Hounds of God. One grave in every graveyard belongs to the ghouls. Wander any graveyard long enough and you will find it, water-stained and bulging, with cracked or broken stone, scraggly grass or rank weeds about it, and a feeling, when you reach it, of abandonment. It may be colder than the other gravestones, too, and the name on the stone is all too often impossible to read. If there is a statue on the grave, it will be headless, or so scabbed with fungus and lichens as to look like fungus itself. If one grave in a graveyard looks like a target for petty vandals, that is the Ghoul Gate. If the grave makes you want to be somewhere else, that is the Ghoul Gate. There was one in Bod's graveyard. There is one in every graveyard. Silas was leaving. Bod had been upset by this when he had first learned about it. He was no longer upset. He was furious.
But why?
I told you. I need to obtain some information. In order to do that, I have to travel. To travel, I must leave here. We have already been over all this.
What's so important that you have to go away?
Bod's 6-year-old mind tried to imagine something that could make Silas want to leave him. And failed.
It's not fair.
His guardian was unperturbed.
It is neither fair nor unfair, Nobody Owens. It simply is.
Bod was not impressed.
You're meant to look after me. You said.
As your guardian, I have responsibility for you, yes. Fortunately, I am not the only individual in the world willing to take on this responsibility.
Where are you going anyway?
Out, away. There are things I need to uncover that I cannot uncover here.
Bod snorted and walked off, kicking at imaginary stones. On the northwestern side of the graveyard, things had become very overgrown and tangled, far beyond the ability of the groundskeeper or the friends of the graveyard to tame. And he ambled over there and woke a family of Victorian children who had all died before their 10th birthdays, and they played at hide-and-go-seek in the moonlight in the ivy-twined jungle. Bod tried to pretend that Silas was not leaving, that nothing was going to change. But when the game was done and he ran back to the old chapel, he saw two things that changed his mind. The first thing he saw was a bag. It was, Bod knew the moment he laid eyes on it, Silas's bag. It was at least 150 years old. A thing of beauty, black leather with brass fittings and a black handle. The kind of bag a Victorian doctor or undertaker might have carried, containing every implement that might have been needed. Bod had never seen Silas's bag before. He had not even known that Silas had a bag. But it was the sort of bag that could only have belonged to Silas. Bod tried to peek inside it, but it was closed with a large brass padlock. It was too heavy for him to lift. That was the first thing. The second thing was sitting on the bench by the chapel.
Bod, this is Miss Lupescu.
Miss Lupescu was not pretty. Her face was pinched, and her expression was disapproving. Her hair was grey, although her face seemed too young for grey hair. Her front teeth were slightly crooked. She wore a bulky mackintosh and a man's tie around her neck.
How do you do, Miss Lupescu?
Miss Lupescu said nothing. She sniffed. Then she looked at Silas and said,
So, this is the boy.
She got up from her seat and walked all around Bod, nostrils flared, as if she was sniffing him. When she had made a complete circuit, she said,
You will report to me on waking and before you go to sleep. I have rented a room in a house over there.
She pointed to a roof just visible from where they stood.
However, I shall spend my time in this graveyard. I am here as a historian, researching the history of old graves. You understand, boy, da?
Bod. It's Bod, not boy.
Short for nobody. A foolish name. Also, Bod is a pet name, a nickname. I do not approve. I will call you boy. You will call me Miss Lupescu.
Bod looked up at Silas pleadingly, but there was no sympathy on Silas's face. He picked up his bag and said,
You will be in good hands with Miss Lupescu, Bod. I am sure that the two of you will get on.
We won't. She's horrible.
That was a very rude thing to say. I think you should apologize, don't you?
Bod didn't. But Silas was looking at him, and Silas was carrying his black bag, and about to leave for no one knew how long. So, he said,
I'm sorry, Miss Lupescu.
At first she said nothing in reply. She merely sniffed. Then she said,
I have come a long way to look after you, boy. I hope you are worth it.
Bod could not imagine hugging Silas, so he held out his hand and Silas bent over and gently shook it, engulfing Bod's small, grubby hand with his huge, pale one. Then, lifting his black leather bag as if it were weightless, he walked down the path and out of the graveyard. Bod told his parents about it.
Silas is gone.
He'll be back. Don't you worry your head about that, Bod. Like a bad penny, as they say.
Back when you were born,
He promised us that if he had to leave, he would find someone else to bring you food and keep an eye on you. And he has. He's so reliable.
Silas had brought Bod food, true, and left it in the crypt each night for him to eat. But this was, as far as Bod was concerned, the least of the things that Silas did for him. He gave advice, cool, sensible, and unfailingly correct. He knew more than the graveyard folk did, for his nightly excursions into the world outside meant that he was able to describe a world that was current, not hundreds of years out of date. He was unflappable and dependable, had been there every night of Bod's life. So the idea of a little chapel without its only inhabitant was one that Bod found difficult to conceive of. Most of all, he made Bod feel safe. Miss Lupescu also saw her job as more than bringing Bod food. She did that too, though.
What is that?
Good food.
They were in the crypt. She had put two plastic containers on the tabletop and opened the lids. She pointed to the first.
Is beetroot barley stew soup.
She pointed to the second.
Is salad. Now you eat both. I make them for you.
Bod stared up at her to see if this was a joke. Food from Silas mostly came in packets, purchased from the kind of places that sold food late at night and asked no questions. No one had ever brought him food in a plastic container with a lid before.
It smells horrible.
If you do not eat the stew soup soon, it will be more horrible. It will be cold. Now eat.
Bod was hungry. He took a plastic spoon, dipped it into the purple-red stew, and he ate. The food was slimy and unfamiliar, but he kept it down.
Now the salad.
And she unpopped the top of the second container. It consisted of large lumps of raw onion, beetroot, and tomato, all in a thick, vinegary dressing. Bod put a lump of beetroot into his mouth and started to chew. He could feel the saliva gathering and realized that if he swallowed it, he would throw it back up.
I can't eat this.
Is good for you.
I'll be sick.
They stared at each other. The small boy with tousled, mousy hair, the pinched, pale woman with not a silver hair out of place.
You eat one more piece.
I can't.
You eat one more piece now, or you stay here until you have eaten it all.
Bod picked out a piece of vinegary tomato, chewed it, and choked it down. Miss Lupescu put the tops back on the containers and replaced them in the plastic shopping bag.
Now, lessons.
It was high summer. It would not get fully dark until almost midnight. There were no lessons in high summer. The time that Bod spent awake, he spent in an endless warm twilight, in which he would play, or explore, or climb.
Lessons?
Your guardian felt it would be good for me to teach you things.
I have teachers. Letitia Burrows teaches me writing and words, and Mr. Pennyworth teaches me his complete educational system for younger gentlemen with additional material for those post-mortem. I do geography and everything. I don't need more lessons.
You know everything then, boy. 6 years old and already you know everything.
I didn't say that.
Miss Lupescu folded her arms.
Tell me about ghouls.
Bod tried to remember what Silas had told him about ghouls over the years.
Keep away from them.
And that is all you know? That? Why do you keep away from them? Where do they come from? Where do they go? Why do you not stand near a ghoul gate? Eh? Boy!
Maud shrugged and shook his head.
Name the different kinds of people. Now.
Maud thought for a moment.
The living? The dead?
He stopped. Then?
Cats?
You are ignorant, boy. This is bad. And you are content to be ignorant, which is worse. Repeat after me. There are the living and the dead. There are day folk and night folk. There are ghouls and mist walkers. There are the high hunters and the hounds of God. Also, there are solitary types.
What are you?
I am Miss Lupescu.
And what's Silas?
She hesitated.
He is a solitary type.
Maud endured the lesson. When Silas taught him things, it was interesting. Much of the time, Maud didn't realize he'd been taught anything at all. Miss Lupescu taught in lists, and Maud could not see the point to it. He sat in the crypt, aching to be out in the summer's twilight, under the ghost moon. When the lesson was done, in the foulest of moods, he fled. He looked for playmates, but found no one and saw nothing but a large grey dog, which prowled the gravestones, always keeping its distance from him, slipping between gravestones and through shadows. The week got worse. Miss Lupescu continued to bring Bod things she had cooked for him, dumplings swimming in lard, thick reddish-purple soup with a lump of sour cream in it, small, cold-boiled potatoes, cold, garlic-heavy sausages, hard-boiled eggs in a grey, unappetizing liquid. He ate as little as he could get away with. The lessons continued. For 2 days she taught him nothing but ways to call for help in every language in the world, and she would rap his knuckles with her pen if he slipped up or forgot. By the 3rd day she was firing them at him.
French?
Au secours.
Morse code?
SOS. 3 short darts. 3 long ones. 3 short ones again.
Night gaunt?
This is stupid. I don't remember what a night gaunt is.
They have hairless wings, and they fly low and fast. They do not visit this world, but they fly the red skies above the road to Gulheim.
I'm never going to need to know this.
Her mouth pinched in tighter. All she said was,
Night gaunt?
Bod made the noise in the back of his throat that she had taught him. A guttural cry, like an eagle's call. She sniffed.
Adequate.
Bod could not wait until the day that Silas returned.
There's a big grey dog in the graveyard sometimes. It came when you did. Is it your dog?
Miss Lupescu straightened her tie.
No.
Are we done?
For today. You will read the list I give you tonight and remember it for tomorrow.
Miss Lupescu's lists were printed in pale purple ink on white paper, and they smelled odd. Bod took the new list up onto the side of the hill and tried to read the words, but his attention kept sliding off it. Eventually, he folded it up and placed it beneath a stone. No one would play with him that night. No one wanted to play or to talk, to run and climb beneath the huge summer moon. He went down to the Owens's tomb to complain to his parents, but Mrs. Owens would not hear a word said against Miss Lupescu on, as far as Bod was concerned, the unfair grounds that Silas had chosen her, while Mr. Owens simply shrugged and started telling Bod about his days as a young apprentice cabinet maker, and how much he would have loved to have learned about all the useful things that Bod was learning, which was, as far as Bod was concerned, even worse.
Aren't you meant to be studying anyway?
Bard squeezed his fists together and said nothing. He stomped off into the graveyard, feeling unloved and underappreciated. Bard brooded on the injustice of it all, and wandered through the graveyard, kicking at stones. He spotted the dark grey dog, and called to it to see if it would come over and play with him. But it kept its distance, and Bard, frustrated, threw a clump of mud towards it, which broke on a nearby gravestone and scattered earth everywhere. The big dog gazed at Bard reproachfully, then stepped away into the shadows and was gone. The boy walked back down the southwest side of the hill, avoiding the old chapel. He did not want to see the place that Silas wasn't. Bod stopped beside a grave that looked the way he felt. It was beneath an oak that had once been struck by lightning and now was just a black trunk, like a sharp talon coming out of the hill. The grave itself was water-stained and cracked, and above it was a memorial stone on which a headless angel hung, its robes looking like a huge and ugly tree fungus. Bod sat down on a clump of grass and felt sorry for himself and hated everybody. He even hated Silas for going away and leaving him. Then he closed his eyes and curled into a ball on the grass and drifted into a dreamless sleep. Down the street and up the hill came the Duke of Westminster, the Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh, and the Bishop of Bath and Wells, slipping and bounding from shadow to shadow, lean and leathery, all sinews and cartilage, wearing raggedy clothes, all a tatter. And they bounded and loped and skulked, leapfrogging over dustbins, keeping to the dark side of hedges. They were small, like full-size people who had shrunk in the sun. They spoke to each other in undertones, saying things like,
"If your grace has any more bloomin' idea of where we is than us do, I'd be grateful if he'd say so. Otherwise he should keep his big awful old shut."
"All I'm saying, your worship, is that I knows there's a graveyard near to here. I can smell it."
"If you could smell it, then I should be able to smell it, because I've got a better nose than you have, your grace."
All this as they dodged and wove their way through suburban gardens. They avoided one garden.
"Psst! Dogs!"
And ran along the top of the garden wall, scampering over it like rats the size of children. Down into the high street, and up the road to the top of the hill. And then they were at the graveyard wall. And they went up it, like squirrels up a tree. And they sniffed the air.
"Where, dog?"
"Where? I don't know. Somewhere around here. Doesn't smell like a proper dog anyway."
"Somebody couldn't smell this graveyard neither, remember? It's just a dog."
The three of them leapt down from the wall to the ground, and they ran, using their arms as much as their legs, to propel themselves through the graveyard, to the ghoul gate by the lightning tree. And beside the gate, in the moonlight, they paused.
"What's this when it's at home, then?"
"Lummy!"
Bod woke then. The three faces staring into his could have been those of mummified humans, fleshless and dried. But their features were mobile and interested, mouths that grinned to reveal sharp, stained teeth, bright beady eyes, clawed fingers that moved and tapped.
"Who are you?"
"We is most important folk, we is. This here is the Duke of Westminster,"
said one of the creatures. They were, Bod realized, only a little bigger than he was. The biggest of the creatures gave a bow.
"Charmed, I'm sure."
"And this is the Bishop of Bath and Wells."
The creature which grinned sharp teeth, and let a pointed tongue of improbable length waggle between them, did not look like Bod's idea of a bishop. Its skin was piebald, and it had a large spot across one eye, making it look almost piratical.
"And I have the honour to be their Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh, at your service."
The three creatures bowed as one.
"Now, me lad, what's your story, eh? And don't tell any Porkies. Remember as how you're talking to a bishop."
"You tell him, your worship.
So Bod told them. He told them how no one liked him or wanted to play with him, how no one appreciated him or cared, and how even his guardian had abandoned him.
"Blow me down,"
said the Duke of Westminster, scratching his nose, a little dried-up thing that was mostly nostrils.
"What you need is to go somewhere the people would appreciate you."
"There isn't anywhere, and I'm not allowed out of the graveyard."
"You needs an whole world of friends and playfellows,"
said the Bishop of Bath and Wells, wiggling his long tongue.
"A city of delights, of fun and magic, where you would be appreciated, not ignored."
"The lady who's looking after me, she makes horrible food. Hard-boiled egg soup and things."
"Food? Where we're going, the food's the best in the whole world. Makes me tum rumble and me mouth water just thinking about it."
"Can I come with you?"
"Come with us?"
"Don't be like that, Your Grace. Have a blinking heart. Look at the little mite. Hasn't had a decent meal in he don't know how long."
"I vote to take him. There's good grub back at our place."
He patted his stomach to show just how good the food was.
"So, you game for adventure?"
asked the Duke of Westminster, won over by the novel idea.
"Or do you want to waste the rest of your life here?"
And with bony fingers, he indicated the graveyard and the night. Bod thought of Miss Lupescu and her awful food and her lists and her pinched mouth.
"I'm game."
His three new friends might have been his size, but they were far stronger than any child. And Bod found himself picked up by the Bishop of Bath and Wells and held high above the creature's head, while the Duke of Westminster grabbed a handful of mangy-looking grass, shouted what sounded like,
"Skarg! Feg! Cavagar!"
and pulled. The stone slab that covered the grave swung open like a trapdoor, revealing a darkness beneath.
"Quick now!"
And the Bishop of Bath and Wells tossed Bod into the dark opening, then leapt in after him, followed by the Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh, and then, with one agile bound, by the Duke of Westminster, who, as soon as he was inside, called out,
"Wake! Parados!"
to close the ghoul gate, and the stone crashed down above them. Bod fell, tumbling through the darkness like a lump of marble, too startled to be scared, wondering how deep the hole beneath that grave could possibly be, when two strong hands caught him beneath the armpits, and he found himself swinging forward through the pitch blackness. Bod had not experienced total darkness for many years. In the graveyard he saw as the Dead Sea, and no tomb or grave or crypt was truly dark to him. Now he was in utter darkness, feeling himself being pitched forward in a sequence of jerks and rushes, the wind rushing past him. It was frightening, but it was also exhilarating. And then there was light, and everything changed. The sky was red, but not the warm red of a sunset. This was an angry, glowering red, the colour of an infected wound. The sun was small, and seemed like it was old and distant. The air was cold, and they were descending a wall. Tombstones and statues jutted out of the side of the wall, as if